Someday men and women, boys and girls will rise. They will reach the mountain peak. They will meet strong and free, ready to receive, to partake, and to bask in the golden rays of love. What fancy! What imagination! What poetic genius can foresee the potentialities of such a force in the lives we share? A bold model of love, compassion, social action, and justice for ourselves, our society, and our planet. Welcome, everybody, on this fabulous fall morning. Take a moment to greet your neighbors and wish them well. Welcome, everyone, to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan, Kansas. It's become quite lively after a slow start, so we appreciate and welcome that. And we would invite anybody who's interested in knowing more about membership to talk to me or Shirley Hobrack, who is standing behind us. We bid you welcome, who come with weary spirit seeking rest, who come with troubles that are too much with you, who come hurt and afraid. We bid you welcome, who come with hope in your heart, who come with anticipation in your step, who come proud and joyous. We bid you welcome, who are seekers of a new faith, who come to probe and explore, who come to learn. We bid you welcome, who enter this hall as a homecoming, who have found here room for your spirit, who find in this people a family. Whoever you are, whatever you are, whomever you love, wherever you are at on your journey, you are welcome here.
I'll love you till I'll love you till the butterflies. I'll love you till the butterflies until the sugar bowls. I'll love you till the kitchen sinks and the celery stalks the rolls. I'll love you till the bacon strips until the fire flies. I'm yours till the ocean sees, just like it has two eyes. The day you see a pocket watch, a barn dance all night, the day a grape jams on the stage, you know that I'll be gone.
Now let us stand as you are able and sing our opening hymn, We Are a Gentle, Angry People, number 170.
Thank you.
Draw your attention to the announcements in our order of service, and we have two or three more spots in the spiritual ecology class, which promises to be a great adventure into the depths of what it means to be alive and living on this planet in harmony. Ours is a welcoming community where we find a connection, a loving community where we find meaning. Ours is a sharing community where our joys are amplified, a caring community where our sorrows are lessened. We take this moment to reflect on our joys and sorrows and acknowledge the mutual support of our community. If you would please, this is the time to now share a personal statement of special joy or sorrow.
Dick Beeman. My joy is that I'm a member of the production of the Manhattan Art Center production of Pirates of Penzance, which opens next Friday. My joy will be increased if I see many of you there.
I'm Nick, and I have a joy that my mom came back from Canada.
May we remember those who have spoken, those we have named, and those we hold in silence in our hearts.
Come on up.
Children, children, come visit me. Good morning. Hi. Oh, I see we have some princesses coming. Excellent. Hi, and My Little Ponies. Good morning, everybody. So today, I don't know if you've noticed, but some people have been talking about love in here. And I was wondering, I know almost everybody here, but I want to know, and I think other people here want to know, who do you guys love? Can you tell us each maybe one or two people that you love? Leah, who do you love?
My mom and my dad. My family. My daddy. Pink horses.
Anybody else? Rose?
I know you love something.
My dog.
Yes. I love your dog too. Kaya?
My Grammy.
I know that everybody here loves somebody. I think everybody here loves lots of people, right? Yeah. I really love Indigo and Burke a lot. Yeah. And I love my sister. I have a sister, and she loves her kids, too, and she loves her husband. His name is Derek. And I love my mom. My mom loves us a lot, and you guys. And I love my dad, and my dad loves Zach, his partner. And I also love somebody else that you guys all probably love, and that's Michael. And Michael loves Charles, right? We all love him. And in our church, we have some principles that I know you guys know how to sing. Do you guys remember what the first principle is? What is it? You can all say it right now. One, each person is worthwhile, right? Two, be kind in all you do, right? And those principles help us support everybody in who they love. And we believe that it's okay to love who you love, right? And it's okay. Yeah. How would you feel if someone told you that you couldn't love the person that you love? What if somebody said, Rose, you actually can't love your dog. That's not okay. I'm not okay with it. Aoife, sorry, you can't love Rose. How would that make you feel, Rose? Sad. Yeah. How would you feel, Indigo?
Angry.
Angry. Yeah. Because it feels good to love who we want to love, right, Leah?
I would feel frustrated.
Yeah, frustrated.
I just want to listen to them.
Yeah. Well, that's a reaction that a lot of people have, too. Well, there's some people out there in our world that think it's not okay to love who you love. They don't agree with the idea that you can love whoever you want to love. So there are a lot of sad and frustrated people out there, right? And we are really lucky in our church. Have you ever noticed that in the mornings when Michael starts the service, he says, "You are welcome whomever you love"? Well, that's a pretty powerful thing in our church. So there's other people that believe that too. And one of the guys is a musician. His name is Macklemore. Has anybody ever heard of him? Yeah. Well, he sings a song, and it's called Same Love. And he wrote this song because he agrees that people should love who they want to love, and they should be able to marry who they want to marry, even if it's a man who wants to marry another man or a woman who wants to marry another woman. He thinks, like, what's the big deal? If they're in love, you should be able to get married, right? So he wrote a song about that, and we are going to listen to it. So I don't know if anybody here has heard it, but you're going to hear it right now, and we're also going to show the video which supports the song. So after the song, the adults are going to sing us all out, and there's lots of stuff to talk about, so if you want to talk about the song or the video, we can talk about it in our classes, or you can definitely talk about it with your parents at home, okay? So, Same Love by Macklemore.
Let us share our resources so that we may build bridges across faiths and boundaries to honor our shared humanity and common values, to become a more visible beacon of religious messages of hope and meaning. Let us share. Thank you.
I've been doing a little research, one of the things that I came across first was the text of Amendment 1, which was passed in Kansas in 2006 and proposed in 2005, I thought it'd be helpful to read what it says. This is the law of the Constitution of Kansas by a 70% to 30% vote. The marriage contract is to be considered in law as a civil contract. Marriage shall be constituted by one man and one woman only. All other marriages are declared to be contrary to the public policy of this state and are void. No relationships other than a marriage shall be recognized by the state as entitling the parties to the rights and incidents of marriage. The term void was very carefully used and has a specific meaning in our legal tradition. Probably the best way is to skip down two sections and see what other marriages are considered void. As far as I know, there's just one other one, and that's incestuous marriages. So reading that, and I read cases about DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act in Congress, which was under the gun last summer, and some of it was struck down. Some of it is still remaining for future litigation. So I tried to kind of figure out what the arc is here. And I think, let me start like this. The history of America with regard to identifiable minorities is gradually equal treatment. The history is not so clean. The dark-skinned people could be enslaved, property. Then after they weren't property, they were not allowed to sit on buses at the right place or eat at counters or go to the same schools as real people could. And, of course, they could not intermarry with other races. That finally left in 1967 with the Supreme Court decision. Let's turn to the next one. Women. Women can't vote. They can be beaten. There's lots of case law about that. In fact, for a long time, a husband was considered not very much of a husband if he didn't chastise his wife in that way. They can be given lower wages for the same work or not hired because they might get pregnant or a breadwinner needs a job. These things, you know, they've changed. I think probably everybody can remember these things having changed during their lives. Mentally ill people can be locked away without recourse. That's changed. Juveniles can be put away without due process of very much any kind. It'd be very interesting to go inside and watch one of the juvenile courts at work. Even today, the lawyers will handle 20, 30 cases. And, I mean, I did it in Wichita, and I probably had enough time to spend 10 minutes on a case. Any more that I would spend on it, I'd have to do it at night. And it was common. Let's see. Indians can be slaughtered and all their treaties ignored. And over time, that's hopefully changed. And now another class of people is at the docks. Gay people and lesbian people and transgender people. Having sexual relations used to be not only a felony, but a very serious felony. In fact, it was called the abominable and detestable crime against nature. They couldn't even use the word sodomy until about 40 or 50 years ago in the statutes. Posing as a gay person, not even just a gay person, just kind of acting like one, that's what got Oscar Wilde thrown in prison, not for actual acts. And, of course, we've heard that Russia, they have that same kind of law now. Property relationships, if you're married. Right now, Mike and I are married in California. We come back here. We have no property rights any more than strangers do. If I died and left him money, he would be forced to pay the state inheritance tax, which applies to strangers. not one that applies to husband and wife, which we wouldn't be any tax that way. It used to be that gay people were considered insane till 1972 or something like that. The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Psychiatry and Psychologists and Mental Disorders finally changed, but before that time, it was a mental condition to be gay. And our right to associate by going into bars. When I first came to KU in 1974, the bars were still being raided in cities like Kansas City, and they just arrest everyone who was there. Just roust them out, hope to find drugs, whatever. So over time, I think, the courts, long before the people, recognized that people are just people. Their lives, their liberties, and their pursuits of happiness, which you do when you're trying to go married or when you're trying to create property, rights, if one person dies, all those things are the same. People are people. Goes back to the preamble of the Constitution. And that we're guaranteed the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It doesn't have anything to do with it, original intent or some kind of strange constitutional reasoning, because we are addressing now and over the last 50 years the inequities that existed in 1790. They were there then. The original intent takes you back there. We don't want to go back there. So all I say, the essence of the Constitution, as shown in the preamble, holds within it that people are equal under law. And that's my statement.
My name is Ron Parks, and in April of 2005, the day after the vote, approved the constitutional amendment that Chuck just referred to, I felt I felt furious, betrayed, deeply, bitterly disappointed. I'm a Kansan, fifth-generation Kansan, lived here all my life. The idea that that this state or my fellow Kansans could pass overwhelmingly such a profoundly mean-spirited act and use constitutional channels to express that mean-spiritedness was really, really infuriating. And also, and this goes with the fury, I felt very powerless about what had happened. So I've always been an admirer of Mark Twain. Okay, and probably more for my own state of mind rather than for persuading people to my point of view. This is probably one of those self-indulgent therapeutic exercises that I, from time to time, do. I wrote a letter to the editor. The local paper in Council Grove, which the town, which was the town that I lived in at the time, is called the Council Grove Republican. It's the smallest daily newspaper in the state of Kansas. Council Grove's got a lot of nice features. My wife Judy and I lived there for 22 years, and we were able to live, I think, pretty creative and satisfactory lives there. But any small town in Kansas, and I know about small towns in Kansas, I've lived in small towns for 54 of my 64 years. They're patriarchal, okay? There's no doubt about it. It's the wealthy white males call the shots. That might be changing just a little bit, but so you're dealing with a patriarchal society here. So in response, I wrote this letter. Just happened to mention it earlier this week to Michael, and he said, "Oh, you got to read that. You got to read that Sunday." So here I am. Okay, this is it. Dear editor, I've been doing some serious soul searching during the last few days as to the error of my ways. This inner journey, intense, agonizing, and profound, was prompted by the recent passage of the marriage protection referendum. 71% of Kansans and 77.25% of the citizens of Morris County voted to add to the state constitution the ban of gay marriages and civil unions. And yes, I admit it, I was one of the 438 unenlightened out of the 1,925 in Morris County to vote no on this measure. So how could I have been so wrong? After all, an overwhelming majority has affirmed the wisdom of disenfranchising an element of the body politic they find offensive to societal norms. By this vote, conventional wisdom has been uttered, nay, shouted out loud and clear. How can and why should I resist this electoral manifestation of received opinion? Why to do so would be arrogant. I would be putting myself above my fellow citizens, presuming that I knew more than they, had greater moral insight than they, exercised superior political judgment than they. No, I won't have it. I hereby declare my intention to accede humbly to the wisdom of the majority. So many cannot be so wrong. Yes, I must have been wrong. So, I have decided to atone for my deficiency by acting upon the new insights offered by the majority, among whom I now happily and comfortably reside. Yes, I see the wisdom of it. Those who are different than we, the normal, and whose behavior we disapprove of, regardless whether they do us and themselves any harm, must be relegated to a second-rate legal status. Yes, they must be censured by us, the good, normal people, and this must be woven into the fabric of our laws. So then, acting from this new and profound insight, I ask myself, what group or groups do I find abnormal and would seek to impose upon them legal opprobrium to the benefit of myself and society at large? What group threatens my values, defiles my cherished ideals, deadens my sacred modalities and aspirations? For the answer, I searched my mind long and hard. Many prospective groups came to mind: gum chewers, mushroom hunters, antiquarians, drywall contractors, poets, and human ecology teachers, to name but a few. But alas, each of these, upon honest examination, had one or two redeeming qualities that prevented me in good conscience from recommending their disenfranchisement. Then it struck me. Yes, there is a group here in Morris County that truly offends my sensibilities and threatens my cherished beliefs. White, wealthy, middle-aged heterosexual males, or MCWWMAHMS. What is their offense? They're boring. Seriously, deadly, mortifyingly, execrably boring. I mean, Have you ever tried to talk to MC Wawa Mom? You can find more intellectual stimulation in an anthill, more sparkle in a storm cellar, more conviviality from a lizard, and their smug, condescending, materialistic, and utterly unoriginal to boot. I could go on, but you get the picture, don't you? So, something's got to be done. I mean, for goodness sake, the fundamental values of social discourse, including good conversation, free inquiry, good humor, passionate expression, and all-around joie de vivre, are being threatened by these neo-zombie wah-wah moms living right here in the midst of Morris County. I tell you, the well-being of our community is under attack, and we need to act fast to rid ourselves of this aggressive, malignant disease of dullness before we're all infected into an interminable condition of stupefaction. What to do? Legislate, of course. The government needs to get involved. In this case, the Morris County Commissioners. I'm sure we can trust them and to recognize and address this problem. We can start first at the county level, then prepare to spread our good work statewide. Perhaps all MCWW moms should be required when in public to wear muzzles. Maybe they should be forbidden to speak. Or we should mark them somehow so they're always identified, making it easier to protect our children from rampant run-of-the-millism. I don't know. I'm sure that better minds than mine can come up with appropriate and commensurate laws to combat this problem. After all, I've recently become just one humble member of the majority that has so wisely embarked on a course of constitutionalized social purification. And I'm looking forward to the rest of the trip. Aren't you?
I wonder if any of you here understand the extent that gay people are vilified without you realizing it. I just came across an article that pointed out that the Pentagon officials confirmed that military leaders considered but ultimately rejected the so-called gay bomb. The Air Force lab asked for $7.5 million to develop such a chemical weapon is documented. The notion was that a chemical that would probably be pleasant in the human body in low quantities could be identified, and by virtue of either breathing or having their skin exposed to this chemical, the notion was that soldiers would become gay and thus ineffective. This is our Pentagon. This last week, I had the pleasure of speaking with a number of our senior citizens at Meadowlark and asked them a bunch of questions about what it meant to live at Meadowlark. And I asked them if they knew any LGBT people who lived at Meadowlark. And they thought, and they thought, and they said, no, I don't know of anybody. And they could only think of one person who was not married or who had not ever been married that lived there. There are probably more. But one begins to get a sense that this is not necessarily a place which says, gay people, you are welcome when you are senior citizens. And in fact, studies show that gay senior citizens are very fearful of going into retirement communities because they have the deep sense that they will be treated as second-class citizens. They will be ostracized, and when they need medical treatment, they will get second-class medical treatment. Now, this is changing, but this is a perception that a lot of gay seniors have. And when I talked to our Meadowlark group, they could not understand that this could even be possible because, of course, they want Chuck and I to move in right with them. And I said, I don't think that that's a possibility. And I think that then they said, oh, yes, there's no problem. But I would ask everyone who holds that assumption that it's okay for gay people to move right into Meadowlark and that they will be welcomed by everyone and they will find a home there and they will be loved for who they are there to pause, to reflect, that this is not the perception of gay people. This is not how we feel. And so there are a lot of areas that we just take for granted that, oh, we know gay people, so we understand them. We accepted the marriage issue, the marriage equality issue is something that we probably don't even need to talk about because we all agree about it. But what I don't think we understand are the ramifications of living in a state where you are vilified. So that's my kind of setup for the cry for freedom. Before I fell desperately in love with Charles, I was absolutely sure that I would get married and have children. There was no question in my mind. It is the one thing I knew with certainty. If you were to ask me what I was going to be, that was a total mystery. But I knew I would be married and I would have children. And of course, I saw that white picket fence, which I wouldn't paint, of course, the dogs, the family, the big trees, the yard. It just all kind of fell into a very cozy place in the heart where I could see that glow of the fireplace, the warmth, the family connections, and the approval of grandparents and aunts and uncles, all those things that help you feel like you belong. I had carried that assumption till the day I realized that that was no longer a choice for me. And some of those assumptions are still hidden in my psyche in ways that I cannot even begin to tease out. They're there. They have been with me as long as I can remember. You don't just one day say, oh, no more. It doesn't happen that way. So I asked myself, what was I thinking? Linda Hirschman, in her book, Victory, the Triumphant Gay Revolution, puts forth the thesis that the struggle for gay rights has been a fight for LGBT people to become full citizens in the liberal state. And she argues that beginning in the 17th century, that liberal states had three fundamental promises it made to its citizens: security, liberty, and self-governance. For any person who grew up in the 50s and 60s as a gay, lesbian, or transgendered identified person knows that you didn't have one of those things. Not one. You could project that you felt that you had those things, that you were confident, but you had to hide, you had to accommodate, you had to appear as if you were very strong and centered in your self-acceptance, that you were very secure in who you were, and that you would be given every freedom that every single other person who was not gay just took for granted. You had to assume that mantle, but you really didn't have it inside you as a fundamental strength. So what happens when you do that kind of thing is that you undermine your authenticity. You're always trying to check out who is going to disapprove of me. How gay should I be? When can I touch Charles and not be looked at as an alien? Not very often in public in Kansas do I feel that I can touch someone I have loved for almost 40 years. Do you have any sense of what that does to the psyche? I don't. All I know is that when we are in a place like Provincetown and it's not crowded, it's November and the sun is shining, and we're walking along the ocean, we decide to go get a glass of wine or get some clams. this town is populated by 50% or more gay people. All of a sudden you realize, wow, I feel lighter, I feel easier in my body. You find yourself just naturally touching this person whom you hold dear. An amazing shift in the body and its whole ability to perceive who you are. We know that Kansas has a long history, and some of it is just awful. We know that. But let us remember that when Kansas was a territory, it was settled by Unitarians and Universalists. And one of the first churches was a Unitarian church led by the Reverend Ephraim Newt. And this was back in the 1850s when it was a territory. And it was absolute warfare. You had to be so careful whenever you took off from Lawrence to go get provisions, say in Leavenworth. And they found themselves in 1856, around this time of year, without flour, without meat, without anything to sustain them. The military said, it's safe, you can go. Of course, the whole wagon train was kidnapped. There was a person that was scalped, and his head was hung in the public square to tell people, anybody who is an abolitionist, this is what's going to happen to you. Ephraim Newt went to Harvard Divinity School. He was friends with Theodore Parker, who was one of the great abolitionists of the early 19th and middle 19th century. He was also a friend and worked with Ralph Waldo Emerson. And when Ephraim Newt was kidnapped, and it finally the news got back to the East, there were many town meetings in which Emerson spoke fervently for aid to these citizens that were once their brothers and sisters, their neighbors, their co-workers, who were now facing the threat of death daily. You know, towns being burnt, people just being butchered, no money. And the American Unitarian Association had promised them money, but of course that was really difficult because a lot of the money came from interests that had slavery as their economic engine. So where the money flow came from, it was often cut off because of this strange relationship we have with money. So as news of Reverend Newt's capture reached these East meetings, there were many attempts to raise funds and awareness of how dangerous it was for the Free Staters. Ralph Waldo Emerson spoke passionately about how the Constitution was under siege. Emerson thought that no family, no individual should rest easy till they have made the great sacrifice for Kansas. Ephraim Newt would tell his friends when he was back East raising funds and doing education, he would tell people in a quiet, humble way, I am ready to die for Kansas. How many of us can say the same today? How many of us feel something so passionately that we would be willing to step out and be counted as one of those people that will be vilified? And just before Newt was released, one of the soldiers grabbed him and he hissed in his ear, I'll put you where you won't preach anymore if you talk about all of this abolitionist stuff, and I will follow you into the blazing fires of hell, and I will scalp you. And then he was released. The goal of the ruffians was to massacre abolitionists, burn down their towns. They believed they must not stop until they had killed every single abolitionist. That was their mission, that was their goal, that was their strategy, and that's what they attempted to do. Slaveholders believed they had the constitutional right to bring slaves into any state, and they were going to do it no matter what. Reverend Newt hoped and worked for the day when the American people will rise in the might of righteous indignation and declare, "It shall be no more. The reign of this bloody tyranny is ended. The era of freedom is begun." Well, as we know, as Chuck laid out, that this arc towards bending towards justice is not something that happens all at once. It's a gradual progression. But another thing that I would like to look at for a moment is the Brown versus the Board of Education, a landmark United States Supreme Court case in which the court declared state laws establishing separate public schools for black and white students unconstitutional. The decision overturned the Plessy versus Ferguson decision of 1896, which allowed state-sponsored segregation insofar as it applied to public education. This ruling paved the way for integration and was a major victory for the civil rights movement. Out of that came all of the protest, Rosa Parks going to the front of the bus, and Martin Luther King doing his marvelous work, and all of the other civil rights workers. This helped create the momentum that allowed for a great revolution in this country, which is still taking place, of course. It's not perfect. We know that. But it is much better than it was 60 years ago and 160 years ago. Are LGBT people inferior to heterosexuals? That's what the Plessy versus Ferguson believed. And that's how the Supreme Court argued. It said, if you believe that African Americans are, by virtue of their biological, psychological, whatever makeup, inferior to white people, then you should not vote in favor of this amendment. So the question really does arise: do you feel that gay people are equal to straight people? Does the state feel like gay people are equal to straight people? If we look at the constitutional amendment that passed 5 or 6 years ago, it was the first time since 1861 that the Constitution of Kansas took the rights of people away. That is a dark day in our history. It is prayer wrapped in bigotry. All these people praying. God is on their side. Jesus is on their side. Or whatever excuse they use. But it is bigotry, clear and simple. There are no excuses for it. Many LGBT kids grow up feeling different from their peers and their families of origin. At the extreme end of this spectrum is an existence which you can typify as a fearful isolation. You learn where those safe places are in your life, and you move to them readily. And you learn to avoid so many of those things which make you feel not wanted. I wrote a poem about this, and it's called Spider Sings. I was 5 years old, and I had a tonsillectomy because I had awful, 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 awful earaches. Spider Sings. Chloroform in my nose, I woke in the giant's room, the green walls webbed with dead smells. Strange noise snaked the long corridor under the door down my burning throat. I screamed. A starched nurse topped in a white hat spun in. I cried for my mother. Mom! Mom! She barked in her cruel queen voice. No mothers after dark. Boys do not cry. Trapped in pain, the little boy gave up. The big boy began to grow, devious, full of designs. You learn to be careful about more and more things, the more you realize that you are just enough different from all of the other kids, even though you play with them, even though you enjoy them, even though you have some really good friendships, you understand something has got to be hidden. I remember a time when I went with a friend, Brock, to visit his grandparents on a farm in western Illinois, and I brought a drawing pad with. And I snuck out under a big old elm tree and started to draw, and Brock snuck up on me and just started laughing. He said, "Drawing is for girls. Boys don't draw. Let's go fishing." So we went fishing. And then I can remember in first grade, I'm going back here a little bit, I had to go to the bathroom, so of course you had the etiquette, raise your hand, and you couldn't say, "Can I go to the bathroom, Miss Morgan?" No, you had to say, "May I go to the bathroom, Miss Morgan?" And she would say, "Yes." And so you'd march down that hall and go into that big room with all those doors. And I did my duty, and as I was walking out of one of the cubicles, an older boy took a knife out of his pocket, and he poked it at me, and he said, "You take off your pants." And I looked at him, and I had no idea what to do. The knife was sharp. It was right there, but I knew I didn't want to take my pants down. So I kicked the door against him, and I ran out and went into the classroom. But I never told a single soul about this incident. Why wouldn't I tell my mother? Why wouldn't I tell my father? Because I had learned that you do not go to your parents for difficult problems because they will not be present to you because they are so busy. They are working almost 24/7. They just didn't have the time. You had to tough it up. You had to take care of yourself. You had to get good grades. You had to help with the dishes. You had to do this. You had to do that. But if you had a problem, you better solve it yourself. And I learned at that point to be very selective about the teachers I trusted because we took all those tests as all kids had to take at that time, and they probably still do. And in fourth grade, I remember being tested for your reading level. And somehow I tested as if I were reading at a junior high, as a junior in high school. The teacher was just amazed, had no idea I could read that well. Duh, I read all the time. The next year, in fifth grade, I only tested as if I were an eighth grader. Oh, you're not doing so good. No attention to the differentiation in the scores. No looking at why that might have been. No attempt to help a child understand at one time, at one level, at one point they're up here, and the next time they do it, they're here. You have no idea where you're at. So I learned not to trust teachers. But what I did learn to do was I learned how to be funny. So I was always creating skits and scenes which would get the class and classes just rolling with laughter. I was great at putting together skits. And when I was in eighth grade, I had this incredible idea. I've shared this with you before, but I just loved Shakespeare's play within a play of In the Midsummer's Night's Dream. It's just one of my favorites. And I went to Mr. Strachey, our social studies teacher. I said, I want to direct this thing. He said, you want to what? I said, I want to direct this. He said, all right, I don't care. So I got a cast, and I did it. And I'll read the poem that describes this. Oh, dainty duck, oh dear, which is a line from a play within a play. Oh, dainty duck, oh dear. I directed and acted in a play within a play when I was 11. It was my romantic notion. I played Thisbe twice as large as Myra Keith, who discharged Pyramus with her piccolo voice. A two-quart tin pot topped her tiny head. We wore togas I made from bedsheets and rehearsed in my basement where Shakespeare had never spoke before. On the auditorium stage in the lunchroom, we working-class kids waited for the dusty velvet to part, a light to shine on us from above. Jackie Janoff played Hippolyta, John Kenya Theseus. Our earnest play hushed the giggles, but unhinged them as the lion roared and the wall made a chink. I implored, asleep, my love? He played dead, of course. My breasts were pink balloons. I cried, come, trusty sword, come, blade, my breast imbue. At the sword's end, I'd fixed a pin. I fell dead in an explosion of laughter, disrupting the grammar school rules. Wild waves of joy pounded against boredom. I was a hero and a heroine. Changing into my corduroys, the rapture, the havoc of success careened. Jeff Holloway in his black leather coat, Cuban heels, hissed in my face, sissy. So, a whole other level of shame descended upon me, which was just horrible. I hid for 2 years, 3 years. It was only in my junior year of high school that I began to reemerge and started the Anthropology Club, a book club which became, if you can believe it, the most popular club in the high school of 1,200 people. By the end, we had 50 members coming to these book clubs, reading all these books and talking about them because it became a cool thing. And it was a great way to hang out and not go to the Hyatt and drink coffee all night or do something a lot more risky. Well, obviously, this thing is much more complicated than I can begin to even get focused today. But I want to say this. Ever since I was a small boy, I hungered for intimacy. I hungered for that friend who would see me, who would really see me and love me for who I was, not who I pretended to be, not the person that did this in that situation or that in this situation, but someone who would really listen to me and hold me for who I was. I was involved with a woman who was just a very great energy, but man, she was so frustrating because it was push, pull all the time. I didn't feel like she ever got me. And when I would call her when she was in Oregon over the summer, she goes, you sound so gay. And I thought, what the hell are you talking about? But anyway, the long story starts when Chuck comes into a class at KU, the stagecraft class, and he spotted me, and he decided that he wanted to get to know me. So in the next year and a half, we developed one of those friendships which just seemed like once-in-a-lifetime friendships. You could stay up all night talking about all kinds of things. Who cared what it was? You just wanted to be there talking, sharing, living, happy in your body, in your skin, in the knowledge of yourself and in the knowledge of another person. What a beautiful gift. But of course, this was the 70s. And it took us 10 soap opera years to figure out how to acknowledge the depth of our love, the commitment we had to each other. But it was 10 torturous years, 10 agonizing years of going back and forth. I was the best man at his wedding, and I can remember praying at the bachelor party that he would realize what a stupid mistake he was making. And he admitted to me over the next couple of years that he really didn't want to get married. It was just assumed they were going to get married, and he found that there was this engagement party, and it was too late. So it's just this tough, impossible place. But we're meeting with our lawyer, Pedro, this coming Thursday. He was a member of the Students for a Democratic Society. He worked with William Kunstler. He is the legal counsel for Kansas Equality. He has provided pro bono work for Planned Parenthood for 6 years. He has received numerous death threats, and one of his very best friends, when he learned that he was the lead counsel for marriage equality, said, "Pedro, why would you ever do that with those people?" Pedro was so stunned he couldn't say a word. He's never invited him back to his house, but as Pedro says, he says, "I am cordial to him. But I will not countenance that kind of behavior from anyone. I am a raging heterosexual, but I believe in every single person's right." So with him, we're going to file a lawsuit against the state of Kansas to overturn that amendment. I ask for your help. Let us stand as you are able and sing the closing hymn, 131, "Love Will Guide Us." Guide us.